Good morning, everyone. It's good to see all of you. And just by the way, if you feel like you've seen a lot of me lately, from the pulpit, it's because another great plan we had, which was at one stage, Rob was going to be preaching today, which I would have thoroughly enjoyed, but when he was scheduling his next treatment, they thought it would be at one time, but then it turned out to be another time. Just a reminder, we'll say hello to Rob, who no doubt will be seeing us at home, and keep praying for him as he goes through treatments and his energy levels dip and all of that. But yes, where is God when hopes fail? And we have high hopes that come crashing down. Where is God at that time? So on the screen, you can see another example. Anyone remember what this picture is about? Yeah, the Challenger shuttle. And so, there is that moment where you have that, Houston, we have liftoff kind of moment, and everything seems to be going. And then there was just this moment where, still visible with the naked eye, you realize that something was going wrong. And then slowly but surely, the tragedy starts setting in, that there has been a huge cost to human life, and high hopes have led to great disappointments. And last week, when we were reviewing the story of Moses, we remember that story when he was around 40 years old. He goes out, he realizes that his fellow Hebrews are being mistreated. He has been raised by Pharaoh's daughter and apparently felt like he had some authority, but we're told he looked this way and that, and when no one was looking, he kills this Egyptian slave driver and buries him in the sand. But then when he goes out and tries to mediate between two of his fellow Hebrews, they say, "Who made you ruler and judge between us?" And they reject him, and now Pharaoh wants to kill him, so he flees to the land of Midian. And there he will be a shepherd in a foreign land for 40 years. Another example of a rescue attempt that seems to fail very badly. But then we're told at that moment, 40 years later, Moses is now around 80 years old, and he sees this burning bush. Basically, God's voice is coming from within the bush, and it's the voice of the Lord. Exodus 3, verse 7, the Lord said, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers. I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land and into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." So this is sort of like the 2.0 version of salvation. The first attempt didn't work very well. This time, God is sending him. And so we know that things are going to go much better. But Moses makes all of these excuses. First of all, he's saying, "Who am I to do this?" And God says, "Well, I'll be with you." And he says, "But who are you?" If people ask, "I am who I am. But what if people don't believe me? Well, I'll give you these signs and wonders, but I'm not a good speaker. Well, I'll put my words in your mouth. Yeah, Lord, please just send someone else. I'm not the right guy." But in the end, Moses is told, "I saved you. Of all of the children of Israel, I saved you so that you could save others. So go." Yeah. When God calls us, when he redeems us, when he saves us, we belong to him. Our lives are now in his hand. We're not just there to live carefree. We belong to him. And God said to Moses, "Go." And so then we have liftoff moment. The first thing that Moses needs to do is to go and meet with the Israelite leaders, the elders. So in chapter 4, verse 29, Moses and Aaron brought together all the elders of the Israelites, and Aaron told them everything the Lord had said to Moses, and he also performed the signs before the people, and they believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them and had seen their misery, they bowed down and worshipped. Houston, we have liftoff. This is good. The plan is going well. The elders believe. They are worshiping the same God that now Moses has worshiped at the burning bush, and everything seems to be going well. But then what happens? We find out that Moses and Aaron go to Pharaoh, and afterwards Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "This is what the Lord, the God of the Israelites, says. Let my people go so that they may hold a festival to me in the wilderness." And Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord? Who is this I am, this Yahweh guy you're talking about? Who is he that I should obey him and let Israel go? I don't know him. I don't know the Lord. And so I will not let Israel go." This is the Houston, we have a problem moment. And so we are told that then Pharaoh decides to make the work of the Israelites even harder, if that were possible. So from chapter 5, verse 6, "That same day Pharaoh gave this order to the slave drivers and the overseers in charge of the people: you are no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. Let them go and gather their own straw." And it's kind of a brilliant plan, and I guess cruel rulers and dictators have done this a long time. You know, bring trouble upon the people, and then in times of trouble, people begin to complain. They turn in on one another when things are going hard. They look for someone to blame. And so Pharaoh's plan seems to work, and let the complaining begin. So first of all, Israel goes and complains to Pharaoh. So chapter 5, verse 15, "Then the Israelite overseers went and appealed to Pharaoh, 'Why have you treated your servants this way? Your servants are given no straw, yet we are told, make bricks. Your servants are being beaten, but the fault is with your own people.' And Pharaoh said, 'Lazy. That's what you are, lazy. That's why you keep saying, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord. Now get to work. You will not be given any straw, and you must produce your full quota of bricks.'" You can see what he's doing. "Oh, you guys, you know, you apparently, you feel like life is so cruisy that you can go and take a 3-day journey out into the wilderness and hold this worship meeting and then, you know, wander your way back in. You've got too much time on your hands. That's the way it appears to me. So if you've got so much time on your hands, well, then you gather your own straw, you make the bricks, you keep the quota up." So the next thing that's going to happen is that now the Israelite leaders are going to complain to Moses and to Aaron. "When Israel's overseers left Pharaoh, they found Moses and Aaron waiting to meet them. And they said, 'May the Lord look on you and judge you.'" These are the same men that all just worship together. "You have made us obnoxious to Pharaoh and his officials and put a sword in their hand to kill us." In other words, all things were going well until you came along, and now everything is going so badly. Again, these are the same men who had just worshipped and praised God and seen God's wonders and put their hope, and now they have turned on one another. And I just wanted to make a general comment. It's not just about church people and church leaders. We probably see it most often with our governments. But as soon as things get hard, right, the economy tanks, we get hit with a pandemic, whatever the case is, you know, fuel prices go up, whose fault is it? We got to blame our leaders, you know? If we just had different people in leadership, then everything in the world would be going right. You know, we wouldn't have any, you know, shortages of anything. There wouldn't be any famines in the land. There wouldn't be any pestilence. There wouldn't be any of these things. If we had the right people in government, if we had the right people in leadership, everything would be going just fine. So when things go wrong, what do? You complain about your leaders, whoever they may be. But if we are children of God, I mean, by all means, if the leaders are at fault, we should go and we should talk to our leaders. That goes without saying. But if we're believers in a sovereign God who rules over this world, when things go wrong, who is the first person that we should go and talk to? Well, the person that we talk to is God. hard times should drive us to prayer? And how often do difficult times drive us to turn in on one another and to grumble against one another and to talk badly about one another, as opposed to saying, things are hard, I better talk to God? And that's what Moses is going to do, but it's probably not the kindest and most gracious prayer that's ever been prayed. Moses is going to complain back to God. Chapter 5, verse 22. Moses returned to the Lord and said, why, Lord, have you brought trouble on this people? Now it's God's fault. Not Pharaoh's fault. It's God's fault. Is this why you sent me? Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has brought trouble on this people, and you have not rescued this people at all. And it's another common thing. When things go wrong, is God to blame? God must be asleep. God must not care. God must have turned his back on us. We must have offended God in some way, because everything in our lives should always go well, right? That's God's plan. And the fact that there are these problems in the world, and the fact that there is curse, and the fact that there is pain in childbearing, and the fact that we, you know, extract food from the ground by the sweat of our brow, and the fact that there is violence in the world, this is God's fault, right? It's not ours. Why have you brought this trouble on us, God? Is God to blame for our suffering and tragedy and injustice? But then God, the Lord, responds to Moses. This is at the beginning of chapter 6. Then the Lord said to Moses, now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Because of my mighty hand, he will let them go. Because of my mighty hand, he will drive them out of the country. And one thing that becomes very clear, and it should have been clear back to Moses back at the burning bush when he said, who am I? God says, I will be with you. And now God is making it very clear to Moses, this was never going to be a leadership summit between Israel's leaders and Pharaoh. Now, there was never going to be a negotiation here. I am the one who is going to bring them out. And I needed you to see this so that no one would ever say, oh, Moses and Aaron went in and they were great diplomats and they did a great negotiation and then Pharaoh listened and that's all that we really needed was just some decent human negotiators. No, that's not at all. And we go back to Pharaoh's earlier statement. Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go. This story is really all about God making himself known. First of all, he made himself known to Moses in the burning bush. Moses said, who are you? And what is your name? And he said, I am Yahweh. I am who I am, and I will show you who I am. And that's really what the next big passage is about, starting from chapter 6, verse 2. And I want you to listen for it. These statements, I am, the bookend either side of this passage, and then the I will. I am who I am, and I will now show you who I am. If God is going to become the Savior and Redeemer of the world, then the world will need to know who he is. And so this is how God responds. God also said to Moses, I am the Lord, Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, the Lord, Yahweh, I did not make myself fully known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, where they resided as foreigners. Moreover, I have heard the groaning of the Israelites whom the Egyptians are enslaving, and I have remembered my covenant. Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people. I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. And I will bring you to a land I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord. I am who I am, and I will show you who I am, and I am about to show the world who knows nothing about me. I am this obscure God of the Hebrews. But if God is going to save the world, he needs to show the world who he is. And that's exactly what he is about to do. But look at the response. The Israelites are so disillusioned, even though Moses relayed this message to the Israelites, but on account of their broken spirit and their cruel oppression, they did not listen to him. And can you relate? Have you ever hit that point where you feel like God isn't there, God isn't listening, the plan is failing, where is he? And I'm just too discouraged anymore to believe. But the interesting thing here is that there is a part of the plan that Moses seems to have forgotten all about. And I'm going to take us back to Exodus chapter 3. Chapter 3, verse 19. God says to Moses, back at the burning bush, "But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. So I will stretch out my hand and I will strike the Egyptians with all the wonders that I will perform among them. And after that, he will let them go." Oh, I just thought I was meant to go in there and just say to him, "Let them go," and he was going to let them go. No, remember back at the bush, I told you, he's not going to let them go unless I compel them. Pharaoh said, "Who is this guy? I've never heard of him." I'm going to make it known to Pharaoh. I'm going to make it known to the Egyptians. I'm going to make it known to the Israelites. In fact, by the time that you get ready to march into the land of Canaan will have heard who I am. If God is going to save the world, then the world needs to know who he is. And Josh is going to speak more about this next week when he covers the chapters that are about the plague. But I just want us to see now that there is this divine logic in this whole plan. I don't know if you have noticed, but at this stage of the game, Moses hasn't marched in and said, "Let my people go so that they can go off into the land of Canaan and you lose your workforce forever." In the ancient world, it's been said that probably the majority of the workforce of places like Egypt, right down through the Greco-Roman Empire, the major workforce were slaves. Some people say up to 50% or more. If you didn't live in a place where there was social welfare and all that, which of course none of them did, if you didn't have anything, then you indentured yourself to someone else. In fact, the word in Hebrew or in Greek in the Old Testament or the New Testament for servant and slave is exactly the same. To be very honest with you, the only difference between a slave and a servant is the master. If you were a Hebrew and a servant indentured himself to you because they had no money, God had set up a system where every 7 years you always had to let your slave go. But while they were under your care, you treated them like family. And if you mistreated them, then the same punishment you gave to them came back to you. In other words, the great evil in Israel would be if there were people on the streets begging for food. God's plan was if they have nothing, you take them into your home and they can exchange work for food. That's the way the system worked. If you served a master like Pharaoh, he just bought you and owned you and you were nothing. And he could beat you, he could kill you, you were property. And so At this stage, God isn't even saying to him, I'm asking you to release your whole workforce, you know, a huge portion. The guys that are building your cities, I'm asking you to release them. He just says, I'm their God. I want them to go out in the wilderness and worship me. It's a reasonable request. And in fact, right up until plague number 9, God is still making the same request to Pharaoh. Nothing big. And in fact, when he begins to pour out his signs, you will see he goes in pretty easy. You know, when there's just this staff on the ground and the serpent, you know, and then Moses' serpent swallows up Pharaoh's serpents. It hasn't cost anyone anything other than, you know, whatever the magicians were using for their trick. And, you know, as slowly but surely, most of these plagues that are coming early on, they're not causing any great disaster. But slowly but surely, God is going to ramp it up. Because the world needs to know that there are consequences to sin. And when everyone is happy and healthy, no one needs God. It is only when suddenly the world becomes difficult, then the world cries out, why is God doing this to us? Which is the right question to be asking. And so there is this divine logic in the whole thing. And we can then see through Pharaoh's hardened response that he is putting himself over God, and God is saying, I'm going to show you who is really in control here. Is it the king of Egypt? And it is it, you know, the Egyptian empire that is ruling the world? Is it the U.S.? Is it Russia? Is it China? Who is it? It's God. And I'm going to make it very clear. It's none of these human powers. By the time I'm finished, people will know that there is a sovereign God who rules the world. And if you need something, you go to him. You don't complain to your rulers and your leaders. And so in doing so, God, this obscure God of the Hebrews, is going to place himself on the map. He's going to place himself right in the center where everyone, the people of Israel, the people of Egypt, later the people of Canaan, everyone is going to know who I am is. And so I want to come back to this question, but where is God during these times of difficulty and grand disappointment? And we've continued to reflect on the New Testament because we said that Jesus walked in the footsteps of Moses, or Moses in the footsteps of Jesus. And Jesus was born like Moses in difficult times, and Jesus was taken down into Egypt as a refugee. Jesus grew up in a poor family. And when Jesus turned up on the scene, it was like, who is this guy? Isn't this the carpenter's son? No one knew in the first century who is Jesus. It was just a common name. Same name we use today as Josh, who will preach to us next week. So no one in particular. But by the time that Jesus was finished, the world was going to know who he is. And everyone deals with Jesus now. Not only the 2 billion people around the world that identify with him in some way, but if you were a Muslim, you need to know who Jesus is. If you were a Hindu, you need to know something about who Jesus is. No matter who you are, you know he's someone. He wasn't anything back in the first century, but he's placed himself in the center of history. Our entire history is dated from his birth. Whether you call it AD or BC or the common era, why did it become common? Oh, because of Jesus' birth. He's the center of everything. But at the end of his life, he's hanging on a cross, naked and stripped down and being persecuted and crying out in the words of his forefather, David, my God, why have you forsaken me? In a minute, Gary's going to come and help us reflect on this further, but I just want to say something in the words of the scriptures and also what other people have said before. When God lifted Jesus up on the cross, he placed the world at his feet. When God stretched out Christ's hands, he did so that Jesus could draw the whole world to himself. when Christ's blood was spilled, it was for the forgiveness of sins. When he was laid in a tomb, it was so that he could blow the doors off the gates of hell and death and defeat Satan forever and ever. At the point in time when Christ seemed most defeated, Christ was saving the world. Where is God during times of disappointment and frustration? Always on his throne and always seeking and saving the lost. We're going to sing a song of reflection, and then Gary is going to come.